Thank you.
And it's 30 plus 15, like all the theory talks.
Oh, okay. So first of all, yeah, thank you for having me. And I think I'm not alone in also thanking the organizers for putting this workshop together. I know it's a lot of work, and regrettably only could be here for this last week, but I'm sure everyone is thankful for the work that you guys did. So so actually, this talk, it's about monolayer iron selenide, and I know that this has been a topic that you've heard probably quite a bit about. And I think, you know, it's extremely exciting when you can find a material that has TC, which is, you know, could be, depending on how things go, at least an order of magnitude larger than what you have in bulk for the same material, or 50% or a factor of 2 greater than what you had in any material in its class. And I think that that's just that absolute right fodder to be looking at what are the ingredients that we would need in order to revamp or modernize Matthias's rules of looking at classifying ways in which we can engineer TC to be higher. I think we spend a lot of time worrying about what makes TC low, whereas this is clearly the prize. So the talk I'm going to give is it's largely about experiments, and I don't have that many slides, so I welcome diversions, or I can cede the rest of my time to Doug. But I just wanted to present maybe quickly some things that I know you've already seen, but just to sort of set the stage for some new results that just recently appeared. So I'm sure you've seen this, that the initial work in 2012 of really something remarkable, that the one monolayer of iron selenide is greater than what you have iron selenide under bulk, or greater than what you have under pressure with the resistive transition, well, depending on where you pick it, somewhere in between 30 to 60 K. And I've already heard this discussed, although I'm very interested to hear. I think somebody made a comment that after the workshop, people are less skeptical about this. I'd like to understand that. But anyway, it's certainly extremely exciting. If TC is above liquid nitrogen, and certainly around 100 or over 100 Kelvin, that would be awesome.
Can we go back a second?
Yes.
I thought TC was 108.
This is another sample.
It's another sample from the same paper?
From the same paper,
oh,
in the supplement.
So you showed the conservative one.
I showed the other sample. Right. So also, I believe Xinjiang was here, and I'm sure he showed that these set of beautiful photo emission experiments, which shows that there is a gap which is opening up in kind of a BCS-like fashion, with a gap opening temperature on the order of 60-ish or so Kelvin. And the message is that the annealing sequence does matter, both in terms of TC, or the gap opening temperature, as well as the charge transfer, the size of the Fermi surface pockets, and the presence or absence of that whole band. And Deng Lai, I don't know if he was here too, but he has shown that while the substrate does matter, a similar enhancement is seen on various different substrates. On the TiO2 terminated STO, barium titanate, a ferroelectric 2%, or different strained amounts of STO, which gives similar large values for the gap opening.
Tom?
Yes?
Don't all of these experiments have a layer of TiO2, or are there some that have directly this iron selenide?
No, they all are TiO2 terminated, as far as I know, but people can correct me if I'm wrong in that statement. That's the natural place to grow the iron selenide. And so this is the background of you know, the state of the art for in terms of photo emission, primarily coming from the groups in China. And so this is new data, which is coming from the group of ZX. It sees a This is, again, monolayer iron selenide on top of niobium doped SPO, grown in situ MVA, not breaking vacuum, doing photo emission. So here is the Fermi surface around the endpoint, the electron pocket, that you can see very clearly. This is a cut, binding energy and momentum around the endpoint. Here is that electron band that cuts through the Fermi surfaces at high temperatures. Around the gamma point, so there's a whole band that doesn't quite make it to the Fermi level. Its top is somewhere between 150 millielectron volts below the Fermi level. This is consistent with the photo emission from other groups. But the key thing that's different that I want to draw your attention to is the observation of this thing that's labeled here A prime. So A being this band that sits up here, which is terminated or stops around KF. And then there's another feature that you can see in the spectra, which seems like a mimic or a replica of that feature A, shifted down by approximately 100 millivolts or so. And so this is the kind of a waterfall of this data. So you can see that's that band A that's sitting here. And here is that other piece here. There are two other hole-like bands which are sitting underneath. You can't really see them in the raw spectra. So what's typically done is taking two derivatives of the spectra to accentuate contrast. That's what's shown here in these two plots. So this is around gamma. Here's the whole band. You can see its top a little bit better defined. Here's very clearly the electron band. And then you can see there is a replica, which looks like just a mimic or a copy of this one shifted down, that seems just to terminate in free space. And then there's another band B, which is what that band which emanates out from the gamma point. And okay, now you start to have a mother's eye of whether you see something at B prime, also whether you see something at D prime here. So I should have said at the beginning, it's important to separate beliefs from facts. So I'm going to try to give an honest description of what are the things that are that we could say clearly, and I'll make it clear when I'm going to the domain of beliefs.
Excuse me,
this is multilayer. This is monolayer iron solid.
On the left it says
multilayer
iron.
Sorry, that's the setup. What's going to the rest of the talk? Yeah,
so, if we're to think of it as an image of the upper thing, then very important to note that it shifted in energy but has exactly the same momentum. Mm-hmm. And therefore whatever shifting in has no momentum.
Yeah, it's very right. Forward scattering. Right. That's right. The content of the talk. I can finish already. So just to show you the gap anisotropy and the development of the gap with temperature. So it's high temperature where a band is running up through the Fermi level, at lower temperature comes up to the Fermi level and pulls back. And you can see in the symmetrized spectrum a gap opening at somewhere around here. And in fact, that's the plot of the extracted gap versus temperature, somewhere between 50 and 60 Kelvin. If you look around the Fermi surface, around the M pockets, and I'll come to this in greater detail, but it's got an anisotropy that's consistent with previous measurements. There's no real direct indication of a node. The anisotropy varies from about 8 millielectron volts to somewhere around 12 or 13. To look at this in more detail, this is the M pocket with different circular polarization and linear polarization as a way of extracting the two Fermi surface sheets. So you can see that here in the cut that blob here actually splits up into two pieces, a so-called inner, or the two overlapping ellipses, the inner and outer pocket. And what's surprising, at least to me, I don't know if this has been discussed, is that there's really no evidence of a gap or a band hybridization near the points where the two ellipses intersect. And it's strange because you have that intersection is governed by the two symmetry glide plane and inversion that would protect the pocket. Spin orbit, of course, would split it. But certainly that interface is killing the property of inversion. Yet there's no detectable splitting of the bands or hybridization between the bands separating an inner and an outer hole pocket.
Tom,
yeah.
Why is the image so asymmetric? The actual data.
This, you mean? Yeah. Why this is different color than that side?
Well, that's the whole thing.
Matrix
is
elements.
No, well, matrix elements. I expect to sort of give me something that might have C2 symmetry or something like that. But this seems to be have no symmetry at all. If I look at the actual gestalt of the signal.
Yeah, that's part and parcel for the photo emission. It depends on the collection and the way you're doing the incident photon energy. And I'm totally out of my league if I go any deeper into describing why the colors are the way that they are.
So it's not an alignment question or a substrate or a terracing question or anything like that having to do with
no. In fact, these are surprisingly okay. So it's hard to say, you know, that there's a symmetry associated with this picture, but the underlying shape of the Fermi surfaces that you get in this direction is the same as in this direction. Mm-hmm. There's no apparent C4 to C2 or any type of symmetry breaking from this photo emission data that I've seen.
But that's yeah, you're making a statement about the second derivative image, right?
Correct. Yeah. Okay.
Are there no substrates that you see?
In this spectra, no. You can make the substrate appear, but in this spectra, by having poor contacts and so on, how you grow the material. But this one is, you don't see the substrate states, any sign of the substrate states. And then, again, just looking at the GAPA anisotropy a little bit closer. So here is mapping the gap going around these Fermi surface sheets. As I said, it doesn't look like there's any separation of the sheets around this intersection point. And if you plot the anisotropy going around the sheets, this is, as I said, there's a minimum at the intersection of about 8 millielectron volts and a maximum somewhere between 12 and 13 millielectron volts. So it's not, of course, there's no statement about the sign of the gap or anything like that, but that was at least a surprise. So, but I'm coming back to this issue of a replica. So here is the data I've already shown you for the monolayer. Second derivative images, that's around the gamma point, that's around the end point, so here's that, those replicas again. This is two monolayers, two unit cells. This is 30 unit cells. So already at two unit cells, you're recovering, you shift back up the whole band to the Fermi level, you really are recovering bulk almost immediately of putting another monolayer down. The electron band also moves up, and it looks very similar to what you have in bulk already. So in fact, and these are the actual spectra. This one has been symmetrized with respect to that green line from that side to that side.
Tom?
Yeah.
In any of these data, we never see the band that belongs to substrate, like Fermi type A?
That was just the question. So,
okay.
Yeah, no, you can see it if you have a poor growth of, you know, if you have blotches of iron selenide not fully covered or not fully connected.
Okay, but these are all.
Yeah, so the lead patterns of these are beautiful, you know, that it really looks like a monolayer. And you can deposit, you know, fractions of monolayer and see how those other parts come up. Yeah. So just focusing in on this M pocket, so that's here. This is what you see at 10 Kelvin. And, well, you can't really tell, but that's the pullback here where the gap is opening up down at 10 Kelvin. And if you track this as a function of temperature going up to where that gap closes above 70 Kelvin or so and 90 Kelvin, you see the band, this band, aside from that closing of the gap, doesn't really move that much. But you also see that that replica feature, I think, clearly is still there even up at 90 Kelvin. And in fact, there's remnant of it even up at 120, 130 Kelvin. So this was a puzzle for a while. At first we thought it was related to, so here's the kind of the summary, related to some quantum confinement because you have that single layer, but the fact that it terminates just midway into the in the band is something that you don't get from LDA in doing a slab calculation. And so this looks like something that you would see where you would have a ladder of states or a replica of these things shifted down by some energy of some boson. So now I'm going to go from that separation between discussion of what the experiments see to a discussion which is a bit more on belief. Okay? So the candidate of what we're trying to look at is that there's an oxygen, well-known oxygen branch of phonons that are between 80 and 100 millielectron volts in SDO. And the idea is that this is a TiO terminated surface, so this is the iron selenide which sits on top of this layer of titanium and oxygen, and that this oxygen is modulating a electrostatic field which is occurring by surface dipoles that exist because of the incipient ferroelectric that sits underneath. I'll discuss this in a little bit. So what I'm just looking at though is if I bring in this phonon into play of trying to determine ways in which you can quantify how big of a strength you need in order to see that it would give a replica. Yes?
Is that the same phonon that happened in the old oxide, basically a breathing mode or half breathing mode of the oxygens? So in Cooper's there is a phonon at right, 80.
It's this one. It's a C-axis mode, so it's not the in-plane mode.
So that's different from Cooper.
That's Cooper's different from Cooper's, yeah, that's at higher energy.
Tom, this has...
There is a mode like that in Cooper's, there's no energy.
Yeah, no, it's high, but it's just not the high. In fact, it is the highest branch in the insulator. It's the same mode in the insulator. And then it moves with doping, whereas the other guy only softens around pi zero. That's a separate discussion.
Excuse me, so it's really the ferroelectric?
Yeah.
But then you should see the difference between STO and ferroelectric.
No, because I've already got a local formation of a ferroelectric at the interface. So the bulk is not relevant, it's the interface which is relevant. I'm going to come to this.
I want to come back to my point earlier on. This is basically a local mode because it's got very little dispersion.
Yeah.
And as such, it won't be a momentum preserving mode and won't produce images of the dispersion that you've seen in the data.
But you have to distinguish between its dispersion and its coupling. And the coupling is forward.
You're going to claim that the coupling is focused very, very tightly in a narrow region of momentum space only.
Yeah, correct. Okay. And it's simple, right? I mean, if I've got a charge, oxygen 2 minus, that's sitting here on top of a conducting plane, it has an electrostatic field that couples into those iron electrons, and as this guy is doing that, it scatters electron in a cone.
No, because it can scatter at any wavelength, it can fluctuate at any wavelength it likes with equal energy, and each one of those will be scattering.
No, I'm talking about the coupling constant, right?
Well,
here, let me show you, okay?
Tom?
Yeah.
The splitting of the band is also consistent with the energy of that mode, roughly, so, you know, it seems...
That was the association, right? We're looking for something on that energy, and that was the...
And there's nothing else in your life.
Exactly. If you have a better mode or anything else that you could cook up, by all means, this was the one that we focused on. So let's, for the moment, assume that there's a dipole. So that sets up a field, and that or potential, and that potential is modulated as you, where the charge is modulated by displacing that dipole, right? So I have then, just a simple Coulomb interaction of that dipole with a length which is set by the distance, or a screening length, which is set by the distance that that dipole is away from the charge. Now this is an effective length. It includes the square root of the in-plane and out-of-plane dielectric constants, but nevertheless, that distance, or effective distance, is a screening length that sets the length at which that interaction is relevant over Q. So, meaning that those electrons then feel a coupling, a charge coupling from that modulated potential due to that phonon, which is very forward. And so, in the limit of Q equal to zero, and just make it a delta function, then this problem can be solved exactly. It's our
No, I don't understand why it should be a delta function. If you make the decay in momentum space extremely sharp.
Yeah.
Whereas it's not going to be, it's going to be decaying over a length scale of order the inverse lattice spacing, which is not sharp.
No, the distance, not
okay.
the lattice.
Well, is that, how high is that distance?
What is H0?
Yeah, what is H0?
The number.
Yeah.
I think 4.2 angstroms.
So it's not very large. I mean, like in the, you know, in the quantum Hall systems, right, they use the same argument, you know, why you get such long infinite paths, right? But they're only talking, you know, hundreds of angstroms.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this would then smear things over that range in inverse momentum space. So but they were very sharply focused in the data.
There is a possible assistance here, mm-hmm. which is if you have an isotropic dielectric constant, that length is amplified by square root of epsilon in plane over epsilon perpendicular.
Okay.
I don't know how anisotropic the dielectric constants are, but...
That could go either way, of course.
So I would assume the in plane...
It goes in the right direction. But I can even take the opposite point of view. Mm-hmm. Is I'm going to take this, is what I'm going to do. I'm going to take that as a parameter. I'm going to run through a calculation and tell you what it is.
Yeah.
And then, you know, fit it that way. But I wanted to show that, you know, why is it it's not a delta function, but when it is a delta function, you get the spectrum
sure.
of height,
absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
So that you get a set of ladder states which are split off exactly by the boson, the omega naught, that energy scale. And importantly, the amplitude of that peak relative to this one or this one relative to that one is the effective way of determining what that coupling mm-hmm. constant is.
Sure.
Okay? So that's the idea. But so what we did is instead is just do Elie-Ashberg with the form of that coupling constant. So that's this G of Q that's sitting in here. So this is the usual thing. Coupling to a dispersionless mode with that coupling constant and just iterate, do self-consistent with consistency of calculating the self-energy. So. We took 80 MeV for the frequency, and here's a Q0 that we used, so 0.3 over A in units.
A question?
Yeah.
You say Elie-Ashberg, but there's no superconductivity yet in these equations, right?
No superconductivity.
Okay, it's just a self-assistant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is the calculated spectra. So we input the two bands, so the whole band, the electron band, and then that is the replica of this one, and here is a weaker replica of this one. And if you calculate a momentum average lambda, that is a big number on the order of a half for this calculation. Why did we choose those? So this is the comparison of the experiment up top with the data below. Or calculation below. This is a cut through the line through here from theory and integrated along this box in an experiment. Obviously, there's a source of broadening that we're not taking into account in the calculation and so on. That could affect the relative intensities and so on. So that's a strong caveat. But making a fit between or a match between the intensity of A and A prime and B and B prime was what chose us to give the numbers that we did. And so for that choice of that cutoff, you can see, well, you can't really see here because there's another band which is overlying it, that there is some smearing out around this edge relative to this one, but it's a fairly faithful replica down around the bottom of the band. Yeah.
If that other band wasn't there, I mean, would the replica still terminate, or would it?
Yeah, it would terminate. Because it's just cast down, like I was showing in the Q equal to zero sketch.
It's just what?
It's just cast down, being coupled to this ladder of Frank-Condon states.
I see, and like the particle states don't get shifted down? That's how this works? Or?
This one, you mean?
Well, there are some, presumably some positive energy states.
Yes, for sure.
And those don't get...
No, they would be replicated too on the other side.
I see. On the positive energy side.
Yeah.
But not, they don't get shifted down.
No, they're just, it's just a redistribution of the spectral wave for the electron into the side bands. And it takes the image of what you have from the main band, another band.
So in some sense it's very general.
These are inelastic processes. Sorry?
Yeah.
These are inelastic processes, so he's making a hole and a phonon.
Yes.
Right, and photo emission doesn't pick up the phonon.
So you can't have a hole in the unoccupied states and the phonon. That light doesn't pick up.
So you're basically saying, if I make a hole at this distance from my Swanson titanate and allow it to move on, that will be my spectrum. I always have these shape ups. It's not a property of the iron cellulite in some sense. It's
correct.
Very general.
Correct. That's right.
And Tom, did I understand the number you put right, that you're assuming that this H naught is 3 times the lattice constant of Clough 3? That I didn't know how to translate from Q naught to H naught. You said Q naught was...
Q naught is 2 pi over H naught.
2 pi over H naught.
Yeah.
I see. So H naught is actually quite big. You had to assume H naught is very big.
Yeah. Yeah. And if we make Q naught smaller or bigger, then there's a kind of a, excuse me, as the cone opens up, this thing then just becomes flatter and flatter and flatter and becomes fatter and fatter and fatter because it's mixing all Qs, all K states, as Piers was saying. So, so here's now the you know, the real guess. Our explanation of what we think is going on. So I think, as everyone knows, the STO would love to be ferroelectric, but it's prevented by from being so by two features. One is this antiferro distortion that occurs around 100 Kelvin or so, and the other is just simple quantum fluctuations which prevent the ferroelectric moment from forming. And so what we know that, though, this is extremely sensitive to various different things like chemical doping and so on. Even 018 in for 016 turns it into a ferroelectric state. So the guess or the idea is that these niobium dopants in the STO provide enough symmetry breaking to allow for these little local ferroelectric dipoles to form. And then the bigger, or another symmetry of breaking is, of course, the inversion broken at the at that interface, which allows for these dipoles to become more stable and align themselves in a ferroelectric behavior, whereas in bulk they're still remaining dilute and not ordered. And the reason why we believe that is from this, or at least consistent with this idea, is this Raman data by Qinming Zhang from Nanjing, which at high temperatures tracking the dispersion of a phonon, and it's well known these soft phonons appear in the ferroelectric state, that you see a phonon branch which is coming up, which splits into two, somewhere actually between 80 and 60 Kelvin or so, which is the same type of behavior that you see in the ferroelectric. And you can see a discontinuous change, yeah, here, somewhere around 55 Kelvin or so.
I always thought that the like the ferroelectric instability corresponds to the softening of the phonon.
Right.
So yeah. That means that the phonon should be, you know, really low in energy already.
Right.
To start from, not that. So that's a different, the ferroelectric instability. That's a different phonon corresponding. That goes soft there.
Right, but then it folds and then shows up in Raman as you go below the transition. At least that's the nominal idea. Yeah.
So you mentioned earlier that this experiment has been done with different substrates, mm-hmm. as well. So, is to what extent do we know the energy of this mode, how it differs? Means that been that experiment been done?
The STO mode, you mean?
Well, what you call the AD
replica.
Yeah, the shift.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, there are a lot of holes in our knowledge of what's available. So, the this experiment, this is the first one to report this feature of the replica, and it was just in this model era FESC. They're looking at strain and isotope substitution and so on, but I can't report any of that data yet, so it's still relatively new.
So I've got a couple of holes in my understanding here, maybe you can fill. First of all, what role did the presence of a ferroelectric moment at the interface play in your previous analysis?
And that this is the field which is set up, that I'm modulating by the phonon.
Okay, so where in the equations did that show up?
It didn't. I just said that I had some dipole back here. Right. And so I have some Hue effective in here. I modulate that dipole, which produces a change in potential. That's it.
Yeah, but wouldn't you have that if you had a fluctuating dipole as well?
Yeah, it would happen if you just had oxygen 2 minus. It's just sitting there by itself there as well. Mm-hmm. So this, but we also know that if you get rid of that niobium doping, this effect goes away. You need to have niobium doping in the substrate. The TC enhancement goes away, not the replica. That hasn't been checked yet, but the Raman's been checked. I'm sorry. Here. That without niobium, you don't see this change in the Raman.
Okay. Second hole. If you just take STO by itself and put a little niobium in, do you create a ferroelectric state at the interface or not? Is that known?
That's not.
Sorry?
Create a superconductor.
Yeah, you create a superconductor.
Well, superconductor, but above that.
Depends on everything you have in the substrate, right? If you don't, you get presumably a superconductor.
Right, exactly. No, I know this, but right. But that means that the presence of this state is dependent on the existence of the iron selenide.
Yeah.
So what's the iron selenide doing to create that?
Hold on. No, I mean, I don't think it's known whether the surface is ferroelectric definitively.
Ah, okay.
So the STO surface has a quantum well state, right? So there's quantum emission work. If you just look at the STO surface, you can actually have kind of quantum well states at that.
But once you put in the niobium doping, boom, you get a nice little band, a pocket of electrons that forms that cuts through the Fermi level. So that's as you would expect, and those are the electrons which purportedly participate in the superconductivity.
So how do we really know that the orbits observed here are cylinder states?
The bands, you mean?
Yeah. Because we know that SPO in air does something funny, right? So why is...
All I had were actually LDA calculations on this to back up the claim. I that's the best I can do to tell you, that it would be unlikely. You know better than I about whether or not this would be something that you would expect, that the STO bands which pop up and would look and mimic right around the endpoint the same thing that the FESC does.
I mean, whatever they are, they're the things that have a gap that opens up the TC.
That's for sure true. And the niobium doped STO is around gamma. Mm-hmm.
So still, I don't understand the connection to ferroelectricity, because as you said, the copper oxides, they're the same modes that live around the same place,
mm-hmm.
phone modes.
Yeah.
And for sure, they have nothing to do with ferroelectricity. Right? So it's not obvious how STO being ferroelectric, what kind of role it plays in your explanation?
This is the most sketchy of the arguments, right? That it's trying to synthesize by itself. I don't need the ferroelectric moment to generate this coupling, which is forward, as I've been saying. But because we also know the effect is related to whether or not there's niobium doping in the substrate and other other features connected with the inductive measurements that I don't have time and I really don't want to go through, because inductive measurements in this material are awful. That's why I'm bringing in or supposing that the role of ferroelectricity is important. But for what I'm discussing here, it's really not.
If we're agnostic about what the mode is, what your fitting shows is it has to be something which has an a large spatial extent. It has to be quite narrow in momentum space. And you've assumed it's a bulk, if I understand, some kind of bulk mode. But could it not be a surface mode? Could it not be something, I don't know, plasmons, for example, they're very extended in real space, very, very localized in momentum space. You need something like that. Could it possibly be a surface mode rather than a bulk mode?
It certainly can. Then the obligation is to show that it can couple to the iron cell and electrons in a way that gives the correlate scattering. Perfectly okay with that.
But you also have to check that the energy consistent with the shift.
Right, sure. Yeah, it has to, a lot of things have to come out right, of course.
Right.
Isn't that known? It's almost fine to look in.
Say again?
That should depend on the Niobian building, so then it should.
No, the energy isn't, the phonon doesn't change it.
No, but it's the plasma.
No, I think we're
so the plasma is
able to vary directly.
Yeah, exactly. So let me move on, if you allow me, just to show that there's other considerations of what that monolayer does on the issue of electron-phonon coupling from LDA or GGA in this case. So this is the work that's from Martin Cohen, Steve Louis, which is to look at bulk FESC and watch what happens if you have an isolated monolayer and put it on STO. And their claim is that there is an enhanced electron-phonon coupling, not from the phonon that I've been talking about, the STO one, but just within the iron solenoid itself because of the strain that is structurally stabilizing a non-sheared, in fact, anti-ferromagnetic ground state that opens more electron-phonon channels by symmetry or changing of symmetry. And this is a big effect, at least in their calculations. This is the energy in the bottom of the electron band. This is their lambda electron phonon coupling. That's alpha squared f over here from the two methods that they use. So in bulk, the number is smaller than all of those. So that's a serious enhancement, but it's not the thing that I'm talking about. And the thing that would be strange is the fact that then you put another monolayer down and you have two monolayers and you're back already to bulk FESC. That means it would relieve that strain completely, which is a little bit unusual, I would think. So here's another one from, again, I think this is a group in Nanjing, which actually looked at doing the LDA calculation for this slab of iron selenide on this STO surface. And this is the phonon dispersion, and the electron phonon coupling is highlighted in red. There's a whole mix of things that come in because you're putting more atoms into your unit cell. This is the branch that I've been discussing up here, so that they have a large coupling which is sitting at gamma, so near the pocket around Q. The value of that they get, this is a total lambda, summed over everything, is about 0.3 to 0.45, and they reference that to about 0.18 in the book. So that's at least going in the direction, although of course it's not big enough to support superconductivity by itself. So how does it affect superconductivity? I just have a couple more slides. Yes?
Is there a physical mechanism for this electron-phonon coupling
itself,
or is this something that comes out of the
calculus? For just the lambda itself?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, there's it's that change in the lattice structure that opens up channels. That was the first paper, and then the second one is more what I've been talking about, which is that modulating of the electrostatic interaction of the STO phonon into the iron solenoid. So they're two different things.
How would any of this overcome the mu star issue?
It doesn't. So what I'm going to discuss here is I'm going to assume that there is an electronic modulator of superconductivity, or glue, boson, whatever you want. And I'm just going to ask, if you put this in, what can and cannot, what it can and cannot do. Mm-hmm. So the fact that it's an attractive interaction that likes small q, means that in the case of, for example, of the cuprates, it will try to pair quasi-particles which are sitting out around there. That part is good because it connects the gap of the same phase. This part, though, it would connect this one to this one. This would be bad because it connects the gap of opposite phase. But because the gap is larger out here than in here, this would be a net positive D-wave lambda. And then the same would be through a number of different candidates. So if this was the case of a hole pocket and an electron pocket, and Q equal to zero means you only scatter within the pockets, then you're okay as long as there's no sign change. The same would be in this case as well. That would be an enhancement. The problem is when if you had that those two pockets were of opposite phase, scattering within would be fine, within each pocket would be fine, but scattering between the pockets of different signs would not be fine. So it's not clear who would win in that. It depends on details. And then if it were D-wave on both the inner and outer pockets, then for sure you're running into trouble. Most likely that would be negative, meaning it would suppress pairing. So what we did is just do a toy calculation, and then this is really toy. Just do a J1, J2 calculation. So take the input band structure from the photo emission, and it's just do mean field for J1, J2. This has a transition for the ratio of J2 to J1, which induces a D-wave state on the electron pockets or an S-wave state on the two electron pockets. And of course, the problem is we don't know how to really parameterize J1, J2 in this material. So honestly, this is just a wild guess, consistent or trying to be consistent with what's known about say S of Q and omega from calculations from Gabi, and is, you know, trying to be as reasonable as possible or even be conservative.
Is that S plus minus or S?
So this is S.
There is no gamma.
But it inherits the gamma pocket from below the Fermi surface.
So what happens with the Coulomb pseudo potential? If I put an on-site V, the positive V, and look at that. Won't it couple through the S-wave order parameter
so
and bring
is,
the effective coupling constant
this
down?
This is a discussion about the, you know, the differences. I've been talking to people about this between FRG and other approaches, mm-hmm. which is in the FRG approach, which is what Danghai had been doing. The claim is that the interaction has already picked up this S plus minus state from doing the renormalization down when it passes through or going down in energy to catch the hole pocket.
So you do mean it's sort of incipient S plus minus.
It's incipient
so
S plus minus.
Using the pairing with the band below the thermosurface.
Yes.
And that's how you... And that screens out the vast Coulomb interaction on the ion
yes.
so that magic happens.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Amazing things can happen.
So here's the integrating out the phonons. You get an effective interaction with the coupling constant that we wound up using. It's about 10 MeV. So then integrate out the electrons and then determine the effective lambda that you would get in the TC calculation. Again, here we make just a guess for what that cutoff energy is, just taking the depth of the M pocket from the Fermi level for that number. And so that would give, in the absence of any coupling, any of this V effective, a TC on 40 Kelvin, just as a way of choosing the parameters. And so then this is the strength of that coupling. These are for different values of the ratio of J2 to J1, kind of going around that circle. And so for the values that we wound up using, there's a kind of a modest enhancement of that, a factor of about 1.5 or so. And so the idea then is this is fairly falsifiable. Wow, I'm way over time. I'm sorry. It was supposed to be a half hour, wasn't it?
We are in the discussion. We are finishing the discussion.
Sorry about that. Okay, this is it's falsifiable. If you've got that this interface is important, why not create another one on the other side? And so a sandwich, which is STO on top of FESE, would boost the coupling by a factor of 2. So that's good. It's nice and falsifiable. So let me stop. Just acknowledge the collaborators. The work that I'm showing in photo emission was done by JJ and Yong Tao. And the whole setup of the in situ ArcVest was set up by Rob Moore, Dong Li, and with supervision from ZX, and Steve Johnson and Dong Hai Li were the three collaborators. Thanks.
more questions?
Yeah, this is probably stupid, but I remember when I was a postdoc, Paul Hanslow was doing tunneling experiments, and you did inelastic tunneling. You would tunnel into a metal, but you would see a shift in the feature of the tunneling due to some phonon of a local molecule on the top. So you can see features there because in one step or other of the tunneling, you excited the phonon, not because the phonon was coupled to the electron, so it wouldn't have been self-energy of that. Right. I wonder if anything like that is possible in photoemission.
We looked at that in the case of like tunneling, which is the right way to look at it. I don't know if I don't think I looked at it in the context of photo emission. Doug, maybe you did.
John Kirkley was involved in constant. I was involved with him in that experiment you described, but we only looked at the tunnel.
Yeah.
Can I ask a stupid question? I mean, you're essentially saying that you direct people to self-shaping.
Yeah, that I don't know. I mean, that is you make the photoelectron in the usual way, but then on its way out, it excites some phonon. Mm-hmm. Or the photon comes in and excites some resonance, which then fluoresces, and it's the fluorescing photon that produces the photo.
Right.
I mean,
that's what it is.
Higher energy. So if you have high photon energies, you have larger penetration depth and longer path of the electron coming out. Of course, it can scatter inelastically in principle of photons. But what you see here is intensities that are the same order of magnitude.
Right. Yeah. I have a different question, a bit of an intuitive question that I don't understand. So if you have this gap non-dispersive mode that creates these replica bands, that's something that happens far away from the Fermi level, right? Mm-hmm. But superconductivity is something that happened only with the electrons close to the Fermi level, and, mm-hmm. and your bands didn't change close to the Fermi level because of these replica bands, right? Mm-hmm. So how can I understand that superconductivity is involved or enhanced by something that happens 80 millielectron volts away from the Fermi level?
So maybe I wasn't clear. So this lambda that you calculated is the standard way of calculating lambda, right? These are the states. These are the states that cut through the Fermi surface that wind up giving you the superconductivity. And so they are the ones that couple to that mode, and that's what the coupling is. So this is standard.
It's a virtual exchange. So you have the two particles come in that you want to bind in a virtual exchange. They don't have to have the energy. How to put it? If they have that energy there, and some if they transfer that energy or more, it actually repulses, so they want to virtually do it with energy exchange that's small compared to the 80 millielectron volts.
And bulk iron selenide, there's this ambient pressure that's at 90 Kelvin, there's the lattice instability
right.
you want.
Yeah.
Or the structural
right.
Lowering of the symmetry from the triangle to the rhombic. Is that completely suppressed? Or is it in the single cell systems?
It's a good question. It should be detectable, but to my knowledge, it hasn't. I showed you the Raman, there was no real sign of it in that Raman, but that's, one experiment. I don't think it's been systematically.
How can it survive? I mean, isn't the substrate imposing the AB then?
That would be a question.
Well, that's the whole issue, is how strong is that substrate affecting the iron selenide, right? In Steve Louis Martin Cohen case, it's big. It's creating a structural change. On the other approach, then it's just kind of van der Waal bonded on the solid on the top, and it's more freestanding. So
then you could argue it suppresses the substrate, suppresses the pneumatic instability, and therefore a lot of pneumatic fluctuations around, which is also a Q equal zero. Yeah.
Which is also a Q equal to zero. Then the issue is your energy scale and matching it up and so on.
I think
Well, I was
just coming back to the mu star issue, so to summarize what I think you're saying that the instantaneous Coulomb interaction is somehow nullified by the incipient S plus minus behavior.
Yeah,
and that the leftover S wave behavior now magically couples to the phonons. And I think that's the story that we're upset. There's the retarded reaction.
Yeah.
At low energies, it's like a weakly interacting S-wave superconductor.
Yeah.
My problem is I find it incredibly hard to believe that the first time we see any iron material go superconducting, it magically has this wonderful screening process that gets rid of all of the Coulomb interactions that produces the phenomenon we know well, the room temperature phenomenon we know well, which is ferromagnetism. It just seems to me that it's wishful thinking. But maybe I'm just too brainwashed about Coulomb interaction, and I should listen to the music more.
Well, I'm not going to tell you which music to listen to. That's a matter of choice and taste. The way I look at it is, you know, it goes right back to the very first slide. Is why not look about taking the good parts of the interaction, getting rid of the bad parts of the interaction, or finding something so that you can have a, you know, your cake and eat it too. That, you know, it doesn't, in this case, it was the phonon which helped to overcome the intra-pocket repulsion, which would be bad for this state, but it could be, you know, screening of other bad parts of the interaction, which is not enabling you to get to the higher juice.
But wouldn't it mean if I really did have electron hole pockets, that then the phonons wouldn't be active because they wouldn't couple to the S plus minus? After all, they couple basically to charge density. And
why would they not?
Well, you can't have it both ways. If you think that
it doesn't couple from one pocket to the other.
Yeah, but it doesn't couple in an S plus minus channel. It couples in an S plus plus channel.
I don't think it's useful to talk in that language, Pierce. I think that it's
couples to all channels.
Yeah. I don't think you're helping yourself with that analogy. It's the question of momentum transfer. If the momentum transfer is small, it will keep you, say, on the virtual inner hole, and it will keep you on the outer electron hole. And that's what matters. It's this question of the size of the momentum transfer and not this symmetry that you're describing.
Well, forgive me if I do need help, and please provide it, but seems to me that the important thing, even if it's a cubical zero interaction, is how it decomposes in the partial wave channels, and how it decomposes in... So you're claiming that magically, low momentum transfer is attractive in all channels. P wave, D wave, S wave, Q wave.
That's right.
That's the calculation.
As long as it's small momentum transfer.
I just have a very simple question. Based on the kind of things you learned from this model, would you say that the two-layer iron selenide story, the reason for the drastic difference, is it fermiology, or is it the coupling to these?
Can I say yes?
That's a short answer.
So this notion that with small q coupling, small q momentum transfer, you can bootstrap mm-hmm. an interaction in from an electronic pairing, has come up in other places in the meeting, and Claude Bougonnet gave a talk about the organics where essentially the same kind of thing was seen. And it's quite interesting to me. I wanted to just recall a little history. Can you put your slide up with the D-wave and the S-wave and different scenarios for pairing?
This one?
Yeah, so in the 90s, at some point, there was a discussion of forward scattering phonons in the cuprates and how they could be attractive in the D-wave channel. And I think Coolidge and other people, papers you know very well, proposed this. But if I recall correctly, that was a proposal that phonons were doing everything, right? Those particular set of papers, right? It's because you can find an attractive interaction.
Yeah.
So did anybody ever actually look in the cuprates and compare as Steve or somebody said, all of these channels are attractive if you have small Q phonons, but which one actually wins if you have a Fermi surface like that? Is that known? Is that a well-known thing?
Yeah, there's a very long paper by this guy. That was his thesis.
Oh.
So we went through that in the context of the kubrits, where you have an underlying paired D-wave state from electronic interactions, and then ask from the different materials and the different...
I'm asking a different question. Sorry. I'm saying turn off the electronic interaction.
Yes.
Just by itself. A small Q phonon scattering interaction. Yeah, by itself. Which is most attractive? I know nobody cares, but I'm just curious.
I know Ola Anderson did this a while ago, where he listed all of the phonons and their full Q dependence and estimated a TC based on that.
But I think Ola's calculation was for an estimate.
That was estimated, right.
And what's interesting is, as you know, Peter, there's a calculation for the iron materials as well, where if you insist that it's say S plus minus, for example, and now you throw phonons in exactly the way Pro's calculating, you can then calculate what the phonons would do, and you find in the iron materials it actually helps a little bit.
That's not what Peter's asking. I know the answer in one model. So we looked at if you're at a pneumatic critical point, which is another place where you have only forward scattering.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is to leaving order, it enhances all channels exactly equally. And then there are subleading orders in 1 over the correlation number, that is, say 1 over the rate of the Q, that choose which channel. And they generally,
which would presumably depend on Fermi surface and other details.
It depends on Fermi surface and other details. We looked at the Fermi surface. It gave you an exponentially small preference for S-wave.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, to very high accuracy, all channels are equal.
It's true for all of the maps, even for gauges. I'm not positive. The thing about the pneumatic that made it special was the form factor, which not only made small momentum transfer, but also concentrated your action out near the antinodes.
Oh,
it's near the nodes. It's only forward scattering that takes you from one side of the node to the other, or not.
Mm-hmm.
And you have either a node or an almost node, if it's S-wave or D-wave. Those are the only processes that matter, and those are incredibly small.
I'm not saying I'm talking about the Q-grid answer. I'm saying, the Q equals zero boson,
it's not as strong. This is a much stronger effect for the pneumatic than it would be for these others because of this form factor. The gauge field would have just as strong forward scattering near the node as anywhere else. It's still a small effect, but it's an exponentially small effect for the pneumatic.
That sounds like a discussion for coffee. Okay. Because I think we have to move on. So let's thank Tom again.